Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
I'm Jenna Wortham.
And I'm Wesley Morris. We're two culture writers at the New York Times.
I mostly write about how humans relate to technology.
And I mostly write about how popular culture and movies and stuff like that relate to humans.
This is Still Processing. And we're back.
Okay. This week, you and I are going to talk about Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
Frances McDormand is in it. It's probably going to win a bunch of Oscars in a few weeks. I'm holding my breath that does not come true. And we're going to talk about the one thing that really, really bothered us about it, which is that it presents this, like, off-brand America that, I mean, it seems to be America, but where? And it tells us where, but we don't really know. I don't believe that. But that same weird offness is showing up in other movies and other TV shows, not of America, but of specific places that aren't, that are both real and not real.
Right, right. So we're going to talk about that geographical existentialism and try to understand why it's occurring and what it means.
In the last year.
Right.
But before we do that, I want to know what's happening in this beautiful head of yours.
Oh my God, so much. Okay, number one. So, you know, when the iPhone came out and iMessage got really popular, there was this whole hierarchy of technology. So if you had the blue messaging bubble, that meant you had the iPhone and you were cool. But lately, the green bubble keeps popping up, which means you're not using an iPhone. And before that meant like, oh, you don't have the iPhone yet. But now it actually is cool. It's like very counterculture. Opting out of the iPhone. And I recently saw it on an episode of Grown-ish. They did the animation of the text.
It's real.
It's trendy. Real. It's cool. The green bubbles are back. It's very exciting to me. Holla if you hear me. Okay. I want to also talk to you about my other obsession, which you probably heard me mention before, but it's a little TV show called Riverdale.
Oh, yes.
This neo-noir show based on the Archie comics, and it's like half Gossip Girl, half like Cruel Intentions. It's so good. Anyway, Hot Topic released a line of Riverdale merch.
I didn't know where that was going.
That sold out as soon as it went online.
Shut your
mouth. It's appearing on eBay for hundreds of dollars.
No.
Yes. So I went on Etsy, and someone is selling bootleg Riverdale merchandise, and my friend Dodai bought a bunch for us. So you'll be seeing it soon on my jean jacket.
Your off-brand Riverdale merch.
Yes.
That's great. Okay.
I wanted to also mention Will Smith's Instagram, which have you followed him yet on IG?
I shan't.
You need to get on it because there are a few things that bring us pleasure on Earth today, and this is one of them. I mean, he makes jokes about, like, Rumi. He drops in weird, like, dime store dad wisdom. And it's literally like someone gave a child a camcorder, and this is what they're doing with it. It's really fun and hilarious. And every now and again, he'll get, like, Jaden or Willow in the background, and they just look so peeved. He's like, shh. And then the camera pans to them just like, oh my God. Like, whoever got him the iPhone X for Christmas is probably regretting
it. Jade is mad.
Yeah, Jade is mad.
Jade is mad at like somebody, like Will's cousin.
Trey Smith probably.
Why are you giving him? He doesn't need this.
He doesn't need this.
He's already annoying enough as it is.
Anyway, it's great.
I would love to have Will Smith be my dad for like
He can
two
be
hours.
Your dad. Follow him on Instagram.
That's true.
Okay, so what's new with your world?
I have a little bit of sad news. Dennis Edwards died last week.
Saw that.
In The Temptations.
Yeah.
Everybody in these Dennis Edwards appreciations keeps talking about The Temptations. They play all these Temptation songs. I am 100% here for that. But Dennis Edwards had a solo hit on Black Radio. Don't look any further. I don't know. It's not a masterpiece, but it's a sexy song. And he and Syeda Garrett sound really good on it.
Mm-hmm.
Now we can talk about the Super Bowl.
I'm all ears.
I know you watched it because I received text messages from you while
it was
on.
It's true.
Which, unless it was a bot from Russia texting me Janet-related information, I know you were out there suffering along with the rest of us. I was extra suffering because I lived in New England for 13 years, and I'm from Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know what to do. I was neutralized. But I have some commercial concerns. There are some things that bugged me.
Oh my
commercial
God.
Concern number one.
Please don't.
I have to.
I mean, no, I know. I just don't want to relive it, but go on.
Well, wait, which one are you thinking about?
The ML using Martin Luther King to sell a ram. Also, the logo was built, or the tagline was built to serve. I'm sorry.
That's a whole show. I couldn't even start
Black History Month.
No, I know.
Go on.
All right. I did not bother with that one because it felt
so
self-explanatory
egregious.
To me.
Disgusting. Yeah.
I figured I'd go in a different direction and talk about the totally weird Steven Tyler Kia ad where he starts out. Like, I didn't even know what version of Steven Tyler this is.
Animatronic.
It's like Mickey Rourke and Janice Dickinson had a baby who was like 70 years old. I don't get it. So he drives this Kia backwards and he ages into a Steven Tyler that never existed. It's such a weird fantasy, like a weird rock and roll fantasy. Like, his driving backwards doesn't bring rock and roll back. It just makes him younger.
Weird.
It's a bizarre ad. The other one was for this service, I don't really know what it does, called Blackshire.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
I did a little bit of research on Blackshire, as I'm
What'd
sure you,
find
you probably
out? I did.
Did
too. I sure did.
It's Prizes of the Fugees, catch all black culture site, where like when you go to the site and see what it is, Prizes basically just, this is going to be the home where all the black goes.
Is this your voice?
Everything, all of black. Everything black that is happening, that black people are, black every black excellence,
mm-hmm.
black. It's just going to all be here. Just a home for black.
What's wrong with that?
The ad is dumb. The ad itself is so weird because it's just it's a blindfolded, mouth-covered black guy walks up to a microphone in an empty concert hall, and he just walks up to the mic, de-blindfolds himself, and then is like, makes this face that's like, yeah, that's right, and just walks away. What is this?
Look, we're in the year of unspecified content. If the Kardashians can have an app for every time one of them pops out a new baby, then I'm here for this too. I just, you know, culture is changing, and I like to see more of it.
I don't object. I just don't know why what that ad is supposed to make me want about Blackshire.
But none of the Super Bowl ads were good. The only good Super Bowl ads, let's be real, were Amazon Alexa ads with Cardi B. Like, Amazon is making better culture than anybody else. Like, that shit's confusing. So if Proz wants to start a media site, I'm just like, look, the sandbox is open because I don't know what's going on anymore. Well, we should start because this is what we're really trying to get at today, which is how American popular culture no longer seems like it reflects America. But within that sort of dissonance, it is actually telling us a story about where we are right now. And
yes.
We need to sift through it.
Yes. Or maybe it's actually just that what we think of as American is just changing and we don't know how to keep up with that.
Absolutely.
Right.
That's a huge part of it.
So we're going to talk about that after we take this break.
Let's do it.
Tumi has a soft side. Discover their new Azra bag collection and its pillowy pleats, satin finish, and crescent shape. Azra is the bag to carry for your 9-to-5 and your 5-to-9 plans that follow. Versatility, after all, is Tumi's signature. Shop the full Azra collection on Tumi.com or at a Tumi store near you.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
We are back. And Jenna, every once in a while I'll have this experience where I'll go to a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be watching it. And I'm not liking it. It is not good. But I'm trying to figure out what about it isn't working.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this experience with this Three Billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri,
mm-hmm.
where I just at some point stopped believing this movie.
Yes.
It is supposed to be about a woman named Mildred Hayes,
mm-hmm.
who, in having lost her daughter, the daughter was brutally murdered and raped.
Mm.
And she's trying to get local law enforcement to pay attention long enough to find her daughter. She believes that the police aren't doing enough to try to figure out who killed her.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes on a campaign of vengeance and violence,
mm-hmm.
to try to get the sheriff and the other police officers to figure this out. And she is prodded along on the way by her black best friend. I will put black best friend in quotes.
God.
The black billboard sign putter upper.
Yeah.
Because one of her ploys is to put up these three billboards that humiliate
the sheriff into finding out
who the killer is. And it's just one of those movies where at every single point, something is just not right.
I would agree with that.
And starting for me, I don't know what your thing was. For me,
was it the post-it note that was like, got arrested, frowny face, go on.
I think, for me, it's the fact that Mildred, who's played by Frances McDormand,
mm-hmm.
is wearing coveralls
mm-hmm.
for the whole yeah. movie. When the first time you see her, she's grieving. She looks up at the billboards, and a virtual light bulb, you can basically see it go off over mm-hmm. her head because, you know what the movie is called.
Mm-hmm.
She spends the movie in this, like, in these coveralls and her hair in a bandana. And I'm, like, trying to figure out what job she's doing. Like, what occupation is this signifying?
Mm.
And then, what are these, like, black people doing in this town?
Yeah.
And then, how are these black people functioning in this town? Like, wouldn't Black Lives Matter be here at this point if...
Well, if it's really in Missouri, then yeah, a stone's throw away. That's where part of this entire movement started, but that neither here nor there, so...
I just... After about like 45 minutes, just kept watching things not quite make sense to me. And for me, I just sort of stayed with the coveralls because I don't know what the message is I don't know what I'm meant to get out of this woman's signifying like a working person's job, like a manual labor job.
Look, coveralls are comfortable. I had no problem believing a woman who sold a tractor to raise money to set up some billboards might have an extra pair of coveralls that she wears in her downtime. But I think it was incongruent with the fact that she works in a gift store named Southern Charms.
I was going to ask you, what's the gift store called?
Yeah. The signifiers of the movie were not matching up. There was the ethereal beauty of the hills that they kept shooting, although this is supposed to be in the Midwest, although the film was shot in one of the Carolinas. Like, it's just... the puzzle pieces weren't going together.
Yes, this is exactly my frustration. I didn't know who the director was when I saw it. I usually don't look. And I just kept watching this thinking, whoever made this movie is just from another planet. They just are. They have decided that the way to tell a story about America is to set it in the smack middle of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And to have there be a main street where people can be thrown out of windows and, like, leap out mm-hmm. of windows on fire. This movie, for anybody who hasn't seen it yet, is surprisingly violent and yet weirdly cartoonish in the violence that you do get. Everything just kept not making sense to me.
Right.
Like, at some point, you get a new police chief, like an acting police chief,
right.
who's a black man.
Sidney
it's Clark Peters from The Wire.
Right.
But why would they send him there? Like... It just, the movie keeps trying to make a point about something.
This is the thing we started talking about because you saw it in August. A lot of people told me to see it just out of curiosity. I finally saw it a few weeks ago. And the thing that we really settled on was in the generification of the American experience, mm-hmm. you lose all the nuances that make America so interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. the loss of that regionality is why it's so confusing. Because a black person coming into a Southern police station would read differently. I mean, it's just, there was sort of a compression of a type of American experience
right.
that made no sense on a screen.
Martin McDonagh is the person who wrote and directed this movie.
He's British and Irish
yes.
director.
What I think is going on here is that he is taking all of these regionalisms
mm-hmm.
and trying to create some kind of high pressure system out mm-hmm. of them. So you have like what he thinks is Southern racism. You have what he thinks of as like Midwestern niceness.
Yeah.
And you have, you know, the movie influences this movie is clearly under, like the Coen brothers and Quentin Tarantino.
And also like the Andy Griffith Show, let's be real.
Right.
I mean,
and you have this stew of things that don't quite make a lot of sense. But they're trying to point to something about like what America actually is, but he doesn't really know. And it's not just because he's not American. It's that like nobody could take this combination of things, like these sets of instruments, and make good music.
Look, there's a reason buffets have set prices, because you're not really expecting to get anything good when you go in there. It's a bunch of things done mediocrely.
Right.
Is that a word? But, you know, there's a bunch of things there, but they're not necessarily done very well.
You just get to eat all of it.
I don't think you have to be American to make a poignant and really powerful movie about America.
No.
But I do think it's interesting in this case to think about the director and the scriptwriter. And then also I was reading an interview last night with the production designer, who's also not American. She's an Israeli woman named Imbal Weinberg. And she said in this interview with Deadline.com, the script wasn't super descriptive about the town. It came off as an all-American town. But what was important in our process in trying to find locations was the physical proximity of certain sets within the town, right? Like, it was important that the advertising office was across the street from the police station. It was written that way in the script to create a certain amount of tension.
Right.
So that, I think, is very illuminating, that they weren't concerned with the actual landscape or the cultural nuances of whatever town they chose. They wanted a particular type of experience between the people who lived in the town. But in prioritizing that, they lost what anyone who lives in America happens to know about ways in which Georgia is different from New England versus what's
right.
happening, you know, in Ohio is very different from what happens in Virginia. It's like there are these regional differences that you cannot put into a hoagie and call it a day. And so despite all that, there are important stories to be told about the American experience right now, but they're all being done as though extruded through like a fantasy simulator about mm-hmm. what's going on, which is a dangerous thing to do, right? When you're trying to talk about these larger ephemeral, actually very important issues like racism, like police misconduct.
The other problem for me is this idea of creating a version of America's problems that don't seem inherently problematic.
Mm-hmm.
They're not terribly deep. So you have this guy on the police force, this guy named Jason, who's played by Sam Rockwell. He's one of the cops, and it is mentioned on more than one occasion that he has done some horrible things to black people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The movie knows this is a problem, but it doesn't know how to problematize that problem. It doesn't know how to dramatize the problem of what it would mean to have a racist cop on the police force. It's just like a thing that happens in America.
Right.
Why not throw that into the mix, too?
And it becomes a strange punchline almost as
right.
well. Right.
And I don't have a moral problem with a movie trying to redeem this guy and make him a nice person or like to try to find some humanity in there. But it's at every point, like he's also this cartoon character of a racist cop.
Right. Right.
It's not a joke on racist cops. It's just this character
right.
happens to be a racist cop who's also a doofus, who's also kind of in his accidental way an interesting person.
Right.
And the movie doesn't know what to make of any of this stuff.
Right.
It doesn't know what to do when you have a town that's as big as a square and you've got this guy and this woman and, you know, the dwarf that she wants to go on a date with and her ex-husband. There's just too many things happening that don't add up to anything else.
I think what we're talking about is the way this movie has a crisis of place.
Mm-hmm.
And in discussing that identity crisis of the film in this sense of placelessness, we realize that a lot of our current popular culture is also having a similar crisis of place. And we're trying to figure out why that matters and what it says about our current condition, because these narratives are a reflection of who we are and a reflection of what's happening, you know, in our contemporary climate.
This, to me, feels like an accidental simulacrum, basically, in which a thing that is meant to be real seems very fake. And at some point, I'm thinking, okay, we're going to hear somebody yell cut. At some point, we're going to find out that Mildred is, like, in the good place.
Yes.
Or something, right?
Yes.
That Mildred's dead, too.
Right.
And she died and gone to heaven. Or something.
Or something. Really.
And then, you know, you just start thinking about all the other places versus spaces that you have in that are happening right now, just in the last year. In the last year, let's go down a list of, well, how should we characterize this?
We're talking about places that exist without really existing. We're talking about places that don't really have defined boundaries or walls. We're talking about things that are either like existential places or actually limbo.
Right. Or they're just non-geographical physical locations.
Extremely generic places, like
right.
Riverdale.
Like Riverdale. The Good Place, which is a show aired on NBC about a woman. Well,
it's about a cast of characters who wake up in a place they think is the good place, and it's about them figuring out the afterlife. It's set in the afterlife.
Right, which is all you really need to know.
The Upside Down, which is the alternative, you know, universe that appears in the Netflix show Stranger Things, which is a simultaneously like weird dystopic horror landscape where a little boy gets sucked into, very Poltergeist-liked.
Coco.
Aww.
Set in the land of the dead.
Remember me. Yes.
Yeah, the great Pixar movie that is almost entirely set in a limbo.
In the underworld.
Yes.
Yeah.
And like trying to get this kid out back to the land of the living is the essential point of the film.
Also Black Mirror, which is revealing itself slowly to be set in an alternate timeline of reality that is connected, but it's set in this other version of now where things have gone terribly awry with all of technology.
Right. The Sunken Place.
Oh.
From Get Out.
Oh, long live the Sunken Place. That is a real place. I don't care what you say. Also, Dunkirk, you mentioned.
Dunkirk's a weird one, right? It's set in an actual place. Mm-hmm. It's set on the beaches of a town in France, like a major part of World War II, a major incident in World War II where these British soldiers are basically stranded on the beach waiting for the cavalry to come and rescue them from like being sitting ducks for enemy fire. And it's weird because the beach is a location, and it's called Dunkirk. It names an actual spot, but the whole thing is set basically nowhere. It's set on the sand and in fighter planes and in submarines. It has like a very specific historical sense of place, and yet as a movie, it's set no place.
Got it.
Downsizing. Alexander Payne's satire of everything, really. That movie is so much better than it got treated.
Yeah.
By
it got
critics.
Downsized. It barely made a splash. Yeah.
And it's basically about overpopulation is its higher argument. There are mm-hmm. too many of us, and wouldn't it be great if we all just shrank down to nothing and lived in these little simulacrums, basically.
Yeah.
You just sort of drive around your little town, but eventually you realize that it's not just a simulacrum of like one suburban town. It's a simulacrum of the whole world. And all of the problems that exist in the human-sized
world exist in the little world.
Yes.
Yeah.
And all of the racism, all of the global, you know, income inequality, all the sort of like developing world discrimination. It's
well, we can't code our way out of any of those problems.
No,
I mean, that's a big part of it.
Yet again, Westworld.
Oh my God.
Who could forget Westworld? This could go on for a while. And again, it's really important to note that all of the stuff we're talking about is a year old.
Right.
Is barely a year old.
But it also goes beyond popular culture, movies, and TV. It's like cryptocurrencies, right? Money that doesn't really exist anywhere.
Right.
The cloud, which is a very clever marketing term for where all of our stuff goes, as though it's just being shot up into the clouds, like silver seeding or something, but it exists in very terrestrial server farms. But again, like this idea that we're saving things just like into the ether, into nowhere, right. But everywhere.
VR, AR.
And also all the co-working spaces and digital nomadism and this idea of not being, beholden to any one particular location. There was this video, too, that went viral a few weeks ago. It was on Vimeo by a guy named Oliver Kamaya, who spliced together a ton of photos he pulled from Instagram and looking at how people posed with the Eiffel Tower and how they posed with the Leaning Tower of Pisa, what they did on Route 66. It turns out everyone does the exact same thing, either because... Well, the easy explanation is that we're all just mimicking each other, but I think he's also trying to get at the way that the human experience is becoming a meme, the memification and the generification of the human experience of the thing that actually is supposed to broaden your horizons, global travel.
Right. It is fascinating to me, though, that a lot of what is in that montage, what it says to me is a lot more declarative, though. It says, I was physically here. I was physically in a space, and I am presenting to you, of course, you know, as oriented by this montage, of course. So it's selective.
There's a way to watch that video and feel comforted by the universality of the human experience. But in the context of this conversation, it feels like it's illuminating the way the human experience has become commodified and a lot less special than we like to think that it is.
And it also it goes immediately to me back to the actual physical locations in these shows and movies.
Right.
Because a lot of them are set on sound stages.
Right.
And I don't mean by accident. I mean the joke of The Good Place
in many ways is that it literally is an amusement park, more or less.
It's,
you're supposed to believe that it's this like paradise of all the things that humans would love to have in this one place.
Right. And that paradise looks very much like the set of Sesame Street.
Right.
Like the back lot of your favorite, the setting for your favorite musical.
Yeah.
It is a conscious recreation of a very familiar thing that when invented in the 40s and 50s was meant to seem real, right? You were supposed to watch these movies and think, you were supposed to suspend your disbelief long enough to believe that when Gene Kelly spun his umbrella down the street and singing in the rain, that he was
really somewhere.
Right. But we know that the joke in that movie, of course, is that everything is fake. It's an old dichotomy, right? It's an old tension between what is fake and what is real. The difference now, to me, is that there seems to be a real appreciation for these limbos in simulacrums, right?
Well,
they're a haven away from reality, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even in a place like Westworld, which is a diabolical simulacrum in which people pay money to escape their daily lives, to do dangerous things and be dangerous people, and to experience the Wild West, perhaps the most generic, placeless of all movie genres. You could just be anywhere with some mountains in the background and some dust and be in a Western. That's the experience that people want to pay to have. And it's really fascinating to me the way in which that universe is controlled by, you know, diabolical corporate interests at the same time. But the thing that the visitors of that space want to experience is a kind of deviancy, sexual deviancy, and to be morally deviant.
I also think one way to read the appeal of these fictional fantasy settings is that the quote-unquote real world has become so out of control that exiting into these tightly controlled environments is the relief. That is the escape.
That is a literal safe space.
It is. It's supposed to be a type of safe space, but we are no longer, if we ever were, but stewards or shepherds of the land we live on. We don't. It's changing all the time. And actually, because of the changing ecology of the world, it's no longer stable. There's ecological disasters, environmental disasters all the time that are completely re-terraforming the world we live in. There are catastrophic administration changes that are, and I don't even just mean in the U.S., I mean in the world, that are completely reshaping our relationship to the land that we live on.
You know what's interesting, though, when you say this, is that if you look at something like The Good Place, The Sunken Place, Westworld, mm-hmm. these are all environments that are under a kind of authoritarian control, right? Mm-hmm. You know, Catherine Keener is the person who operates and controls the sunken place. She can send you there at any minute.
You're making the motion of stirring the teacup.
Oh, yes, yeah. I am stirring the teacup.
Yeah. Just explaining, though, because it is true that there is someone always pulling the strings.
Right. I would present to you another simulacrum as lived by a person who wants to escape problems of his own making, and that would be our president, going to Mar-a-Lago.
Mm.
And Mar-a-Lago being an ultimate form of simulacrum where you want to get away from yourself. And I have no sympathy for this man. I don't think he has any business going there as often as he does, given the problems that he creates when he goes. But it is for him like a form of escape that he can't really escape into.
There's no unmaking of any of these places. That's the real thing.
Right.
I said this earlier, but I do think we are experiencing a crisis of place that is reflected in a very real crisis of place, which is it's no coincidence that this is happening during one of the biggest reshufflings of people in our modern time. I mean, we're having our country is in the midst of an immigration and identity crisis.
We've never been more displaced. We've never been more diasporic.
We've never been more confused about what it means to call home home.
When home doesn't want you here.
When home doesn't want you here, when what, for many people, their definition of home is being taken away in ICE raids and being reformulated. I mean, it's a very strange time in American culture to be trying to figure out what it means to live here.
Okay, so let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll just talk about what the costs of some of this placelessness and dislocation are.
This podcast is supported by the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
The thing that we're talking about, the thing that really bothers me about Three Billboards, is that in its being off-brand America, I also don't think it even cares about the fictional place it's created.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it knows what its own rules are. I don't think it cares about the places it meets up with in whatever sort of larger point about America it is hoping to try to make.
Right.
And that reminds me of what's happening in actual American neighborhoods when people move in and don't care about the space they live in.
Right.
And the space could be, the space sort of provides a kind of chic. Or as a fun place to live, and it doesn't care about the history of that place.
Yeah.
Or maybe it cares, but it wants the cool of that history and not the work of having to understand what the history is.
Sure.
it's almost as if Ebbing, Missouri, according to this movie, has been gentrified in some way of its history, of its problems. It sort of makes fun and cute and all about Mildred these other problems. And that's sort of what bothers me, too.
Yeah, that's valid.
But at the same time, there is this alternative depiction of real specific space that does feel actual and lived in. And a lot of those depictions happen to be by and
yes.
featuring.
By us, for us. For us, by us.
Well done, Mr. Dash. It's Black people.
Yeah.
It is shows set in specific places and featuring African Americans or actual Africans.
Let's go through the list, though, because it's a long list, and actually it's pretty interesting. So I'll start, and then you go. Queen Sugar. Very much rooted in a place called Louisiana.
Atlanta.
Yes.
Very much set in a place called Atlanta.
Even Insecure, which is very much about the experience of Black people on the West Coast, specifically L.A.
Mm-hmm. As is Blackish in its way, like a classic sitcom.
Right, right.
But achievable in some ways only through a kind of Los Angeles
right.
Black culture.
And The Chi.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
I mean, that's about Chicago. Moonlight, yes. too, which is about very much about an experience in South Florida.
Mm-hmm. And then opening in 2 weeks, or 1 week now,
mm-hmm.
Black Panther.
Mm-hmm.
The fictional land of Wakanda, I know.
Yes. But however, it's still very much supposed to be a definitive place that is being defended from outside influences encroaching upon
yes.
it.
Yes, yes. And so I think there is this real appreciation in some ways when it comes to depictions of place on behalf of Black people that I just feel like we have such a fraught relationship with property in the first place
mm-hmm.
that to just not contest it and to just or to not feel a kinship to place.
Well, of course. I mean, a lot of the diaspora is defined by what we're calling as placelessness,
mm-hmm.
forced and otherwise, you
right,
know?
Right.
So the figuring out how to locate oneself in a place has always been essential.
Yes.
It's funny because I think geography is something we've always taken for granted,
mm-hmm.
that we'll have access to land or we'll have access to things or we'll have access to the ability to go other places. I've been reading a lot of books by geographers in the 1970s, including Yifu Tuan and Edward Ralph, who write a lot about the geography of humans
mm-hmm.
and what it means for people to embody a place. And that's not to say necessarily they're talking about the culture people bring with them, but just the ways in which how humans are located in space, which is a container for place, which is all, it's weird because it was the 70s. But this idea that it is. But just this idea that in order to fully be able to comprehend what it means to live on Earth, which is beyond our comprehension, really, right? Like, it's just we live on Earth, but we're not really capable of thinking about what that means.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So in order to grasp the scale of problems that plague our Earth, climate change, ecological evolution, like just things that are beyond us to really be able to comprehend because the scale is so large, we have to really fully understand where we are in a place in space. And Edward Ralph wrote that the deliberate making of standardized landscapes relates to the weakening of identity, which to the point where they offer all the same bland possibilities for experience. I mean, it's he equates it to place destruction.
Worst nightmare.
Yeah.
It's the generification of everything
yeah.
so that nothing means anything. And you can just move the props around and just say that it's a place and people will believe you.
And these guys thought this was more destructive and more catastrophic than the unmaking of a place. Like the lack of a spiritual connection to a place and understanding where it is was more catastrophic than like the physical eradication of like a town or a city.
Because all the markers are gone. And in
yeah.
psychology, they would say that like that is in some ways the destruction of what you would call a primal scene, basically. This place that you can go back to reorient yourself either as a possibility of healing or is the re-experiencing of trauma. But either way, that marker needs to be there so you know to either enter or avoid it. It's just really the idea that you can destroy that marker
mm-hmm.
and be utterly psychically adrift is a problem too.
Right. So it's weird because it's like, you know, we should be finding freedom in this lack of specificity and this sort of, you know, homogenization. But actually, we need the opposite. We need to know where we are. Right. We need to understand the exact problems that plague a town like Ebbing, Missouri.
Oh, Lord.
in order to locate it in time. Like, we have to in order to relate to it.
It has to seem identifiably real in some way. Well, that's our show.
Still Processing is a product of the New York Times.
It's produced by Jenna Weiss-Berman and Josh Gwynn and Ann Hepperman and Henry Molosky and Jessica Jupiter and Max Linsky. They're all from Pineapple Street Media.
Our editor is Sasha Weiss. We also have editorial oversight from Lisa Tobin and Samantha Hennig.
And our theme music's by Kindness. It's called World Restart from his album Otherness.
You can find all of our episodes and various things at nytimes.com/stillprocessing. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts.
One more thing.
Who do you think you are, Steve Jobs? Anyway, go on.
You and I are going to try to do a very special episode about racism.
We are.
But, you know, you and I frequently talk about racism anyway, so a lot of people are like, oh, shocker.
What else is new?
But there is a form of racism. There is a group that experiences racism that does not get talked about enough.
Right.
And that's Asians and Asian Americans.
Yes.
And so I thought, and you thought, that it would be useful to try to talk about those experiences with Asians and Asian Americans. But we want to put a call out to everybody to call into the show. And basically what we want to hear is whether you've experienced racism, how you feel about the depiction of Asians and Asian Americans in popular culture, meaning music, television, advertising, movies,
the whole shebang.
Whatever is driving you crazy and has been driving you crazy.
So you can give us a call, leave us a voice message at 405-458-4237, which is also 405-45-VIBES, or send us a voice memo. It's stillprocessing@nytimes.com. Try to keep your thoughts under a minute, but we definitely want to hear these first-hand accounts, so please call us.
Please, please, please.
And thank you so much for sharing these personal stories. Love, Jenna and Wesley.
Smart Wool makes merino wool socks and apparel designed to keep you comfortable, so you can do all the things you love outside, all day long. Get 15% off on smartwool.com. Smart Wool. Go far. Feel good.